In chapter 22, we'll talk about female genital pathology. We'll begin with the vulva, and we'll start talking about condyloma acuminata. These are warty lesions that occur anywhere on the vulva, perineum, vagina, and even on the cervix as well. You should remember that they're associated with human papillomavirus, especially subtypes 6 and 11. Under the microscope, you will see coelocytosis, that's a change within the squamous epithelium due to the virus. Next in your handout is called a papillary hydroadenoma. This is a benign tumor, tends to occur along the milk line. And under the microscope, it actually resembles an intraductal papilloma. Very similar histology. Next in your handout is Paget's disease of the vulva. It usually involves the labia majora. On gross, you tend to have a red erythematous crusted rash. If you did a biopsy, you'll see malignant cells percolating within the epidermis. That's characteristic of Paget's. It's not usually associated with an underlying tumor. We think it arises from sweat glands, but it's not confirmed. Let's move on to the vagina. Two big areas we need to talk about. The first is called vaginal adenosis and clear cell adenocarcinoma. Both are incredibly rare, but the board has asked about the association in the past with women who've used DES, diethylstilbestrol. When women were treated with diethylstilbestrol during pregnancy, the female infants are at increased risk of developing clear cell adenosis and clear cell vaginal carcinoma. The other thing I want to talk about is embryonal rhabdomyosarcoma. The other name for this is sarcoma botryoides. This usually affects young children, almost always under the age of 4. And the presentation is classic. They'll come in and protruding from the vagina are these grape-like masses. When you do a biopsy of them and look it under the microscope, you will see a proliferation of spindle-shaped tumor cells. These tumor cells often arrange themselves underlying the epithelium. We call that the cambium layer. The final thing is the tumor cells are muscle cells. It's a muscle tumor, so it will stain with the intermediate filament called desmin. Okay, let's move on to the cervix and talk about pelvic inflammatory disease, also known as pus in der. It's commonly due to an ascending infection from the genital system. It's commonly associated with STDs, especially gonococcus and chlamydia. Let's look at the distribution of diseases. It can go on to the endometrium and give you an endometritis. If the infection goes up into the fallopian tubes, you'll develop a salpingitis. If it goes up to the pelvic cavity, you can get a pelvic peritonitis or pelvic abscesses. The last part is a serious one. It's called the Fitz-Hughes-Curtis syndrome. This is basically perihepatitis. What you'll see in this condition is you'll actually see adhesions extending between the surface of the liver and the ovary and fallopian tubes. They're these long, string-like adhesions. People describe them as being like violin strings. And again, that's due to pelvic inflammatory disease. Clinical presentation, well, it depends where the infection is. If it's in the vagina, you'll have a cervicitis. If it's up in the endometrium, you'll present with vaginal bleeding and midline abdominal pain. If it's in the fallopian tubes, you'll have abdominal pain in the quadrants, either right or left. And finally, if it's up in the peritoneum, you'll get peritoneal signs like rebound tenderness. Let's move on to the complications. A big complication of pelvic inflammatory disease is tubo-ovarian abscesses. Another complication is scarring of the fallopian tube, leading to infertility and ectopic tubal pregnancies. The final complication of pelvic inflammatory disease is adhesions. If you develop adhesions, especially in the intestines, you can actually develop obstruction. Okay, let's move on to malignant tumors of the female genital tract. And I want you to refer to table 22.1, which talks about the incidence and mortality of female genital tract tumors. Let's talk about incidence first. In the United States, the most common tumor is an endometrial cancer, followed by ovarian and cervical. For mortality, though, ovarian cancers are the worst. They kill more people than any other type. Endometrial cancers are second, cervical cancers are third. Let's start off with cervical cancer. In the United States, it's the third most common tumor of the GYN system. In the world, it's number one, though. Why is it only number three in the U.S., but in the world, it's number one? Because we do screening. We have early detection by pap smears. Let's look at some of the risk factors. Risk factors include early age of intercourse, multiple sexual partners, multiple pregnancies, oral contraceptive use, STDs, smoking, and immunosuppression. All of these things are telling you the person is sexually active, because the biggest risk factor is human papilloma virus. And they have asked in the past, what are the most high-risk types? And you would answer 16, 18, 31, and 33. Another thing they've asked about is the viral oncogenes. You should remember E6. E6 binds to and interferes with P53. E7 binds to and interferes with the RB gene. Okay, let's talk about the precursor for cervical cancer. It's called cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. And actually, it goes through a series of steps before you develop cervical cancer. The first step is called CIN1. It's mild dysplasia, which progresses to CIN2, to CIN3, and finally to carcinoma in situ. Carcinoma in situ, by definition, is cancer, but it has not invaded the basement membrane yet. Once it invades the basement membrane, it's invasive cervical cancer. Let's talk about the clinical presentation. On the exam, the classic presentation is they'll give you a female who comes in and complains to you, "Doctor, I always have vaginal bleeding after intercourse." That's absolutely classic for cervical cancer. Another common presentation is they can present with a malodorous discharge because of all the necrosis of the cervix. How do you make the diagnosis? Well, in the United States, we're picking them up really early when it's still in the dysplasia phase. We use the pap smear. Once you get a positive pap smear, what's the next step? Well, you actually go in with do a pelvic exam. You do colposcopy, look at the cervix, and you do biopsies. You want to determine has it invaded or not. Okay, let's move on to the uterus now. For the uterus, the first high-yield topic I want to talk about is endometriosis. By definition, it's presence of endometrial glands and stroma outside of the uterus. Now, the problem with this is every month the endometrium cycles and bleeds. So do these areas of endometriosis. They can bleed. So every month these women get pelvic pain. It's the most common presentation. Now, what's the most common site for endometriosis? Well, we think it's caused by retrograde flow of menses. So the menses is going up the fallopian tube, and the first site it's probably going to go to is the ovary. It's a clear site. So most common site of involvement is the ovary. The uterine ligaments can also be involved. The pouch of Douglas, another common site. The bowel wall and the peritoneum. Those are the most common areas. Let's talk about the gross. If you went in and took a look at some of these lesions, they look like powder burns. They've got this red-brown appearance because every month this area is bleeding. The final thing is I want you to remember that the ovary, it's the most common site to be involved. It can actually form a large cyst, which is filled with all this chocolate material. We call it a chocolate cyst. What is all this chocolate material? It's all the blood that is now hemolyzed and turned brown. Okay, let's talk about the clinical presentation. Every month they get pelvic pain. They can have dysmenorrhea, dyspareunia, rectal pain and constipation, and finally infertility. Okay, let's move on and talk about tumors. A big tumor of the myometrium is called the leiomyoma, also known as a fibroid. It's a benign tumor of smooth muscle cells. In fact, it's one of the most common benign tumors of the female genital tract. It's got a higher incidence in African Americans, and it responds to estrogens. So guess what? During pregnancy, it tends to enlarge, and after menopause, it tends to shrink. On gross examination, these are benign tumors, so they tend to be well circumscribed. They tend to be very rubbery. On cut section, they tend to have a very whorled white tan appearance. It's very characteristic. Now, the clinical presentation It can interfere with the endometrium and give you menorrhagia. You can present with an abdominal mass. These can get huge. And finally, you can get infertility and pelvic pain. One last thing I want to point out is there is a malignant variant of leiomyoma. They call it a leiomyosarcoma. It can metastasize most commonly to the lungs. Okay, let's talk about endometrial cancer. It's the most common malignant tumor in the female genital tract. It's most common in postmenopausal females. What are some of the risk factors? Well, early age of menarche, late age of menopause, never having had kids, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, estrogen-producing tumors of the ovary, such as a granulosa cell tumor, estrogen replacement therapy, and finally, and I'd like you to star this one, endometrial hyperplasia. Anytime a person has endometrial hyperplasia, especially atypical endometrial hyperplasia, they're at increased risk of developing endometrial adenocarcinoma. Okay, the last one is called the Lynch syndrome. We haven't talked about this one. This is a syndrome that commonly will have colonic cancers, endometrial cancers, and ovarian cancers. It's a hereditary cancer syndrome. Okay, let's talk about the growth of an endometrial tumor. Well, it tends to be a tan polypoid mass occurring within the endometrial cavity. The big thing about the prognosis is how far does it invade into the myometrium? The deeper it goes, the worse the prognosis is. Let's look at the microscopic. It's an adenocarcinoma, so it tends to be gland forming. Last thing I want to talk about for endometrial tumors is how do they present. It's almost always a postmenopausal female, so somebody in their late 50s, early 60s, and they come in with postmenopausal bleeding. Your next step should be you want to do an endometrial curettage. Actually go up and scrape out some of the material. Send it to the pathologist and he will tell you, is it hyperplasia? Is it malignant? Okay, let's move on to the ovary. A lot of tumors in the ovary. Before we get to tumors though, I want to talk about one benign condition. It's called polycystic ovarian disease, also known as Stein-Levinsohn disease. This tends to have a very classic presentation. It's young females of reproductive age. They come in with oligomenorrhea or secondary amenorrhea. They tend to be obese. They tend to grow a lot of hair everywhere, and they tend to be infertile. On the laboratory evaluation, they tend to have elevations in LH, low levels of FSH. They also have increased levels of testosterone. That probably accounts for all the hair growth. Grossly, if you look at the ovaries, bilaterally they will be enlarged. They will be filled with numerous follicular cysts. In fact, I like to think of the ovaries as looking like Swiss cheese, because lots and lots of holes. Finally, how do you treat these patients? Well, you've got to put them on oral contraceptives or Provera. Okay, now let's move to ovarian tumors. We'll start with the epithelial tumors. They're the most common of all ovarian tumors. They usually arise from the surface of the epithelium. It's the most common type of ovarian tumor. There's a benign type, an intermediate type, and a malignant type. The benign type is called a cyst adenoma. It's a benign tumor. It tends to be a single cyst that is unilocular. When you open the cyst and look at the inner lining, it tends to be nice and smooth. No papillary projections, no nodules. The intermediate type is called a borderline tumor. Another name for that is a tumor of low malignant potential, and it behaves intermediate between a benign tumor and a malignant tumor. The one that's most important and you should star is the malignant type. It's called a cyst adenocarcinoma. It's the most common malignant ovarian tumor. When you look at the ovary, it tends to be very large. These tumors can be massive in size. When you open up the cyst, it tends to have multiple locules. And when you look at the lining, it's no longer smooth. It has these little papillary projections throughout the lining. You have areas of nodularity. Big solid areas. Those are all indications that this is probably going to be malignant. If you take a biopsy and look at it under the microscope, these tumors tend to have a papillary configuration. They also tend to have dystrophic calcifications, which sort of has a laminated appearance. We call these somoma bodies. Last thing that's important that I want you to remember is they have an increase in a tumor marker. The tumor marker is CA125, classically elevated. Okay, a couple of hereditary factors for the malignant tumors I want you to remember. One risk factor is BRCA1. That's a breast and ovarian tumors, hereditary. The other is the Lynch syndrome. We talked about it. Colonic, endometrial, and ovarian carcinomas. Finally, how does ovarian tumors spread? Well, first of all, it presents very late in the course, very vague abdominal pain. The way it spreads is actually breaks off from the ovary and seeds the peritoneum. It could be on the surface of the bowel, surface of the omentum. It goes everywhere. And as a consequence, at that point, the prognosis is incredibly poor. Most of the women at that stage do not do very well. Okay, let's move on to ovarian germ cell tumors. Let's talk about a five-star germ cell tumor called a teratoma. The other name for this is a dermoid cyst. Now, the good news about these tumors is they're common in young females, but about 95% are benign. Whew. Again, it's common in the early reproductive ages, and it's a teratoma, meaning it has all three germ cell layers represented. You'll see ectoderm, you'll see mesoderm, you'll see endoderm. Grossly, when you open these cysts, you tend to see a lot of greasy, yellow material. That's all keratin. You'll see a lot of hair production. You can also see teeth. You can see areas that are red-brown, probably representing thyroid tissue. Okay? Very characteristic. Okay. Let's talk about two other variants. There's one variant that is composed predominantly of thyroid tissue. When the tumor is mostly thyroid, we call that struma ovarii. And actually, these thyroid tissue can actually produce thyroid hormone, and they can actually present with hyperthyroidism. Another variant is called an immature teratoma. By definition, histologically, some of the components are immature. This has a worse prognosis. Let's look at some of the complications of teratomas, or actually any cyst. They can twist on their vascular pedicle. We call that ovarian torsion. The ovary can infarct. They'll present with abdominal pain. Another complication of a teratoma is it could rupture. If it ruptures, the hair and keratin debris will get out into the peritoneal cavity, and you'll develop a chemical peritonitis, very serious condition. And finally, about 1% in women will undergo malignant transformation and become malignant. Okay, let's move on to the ovarian sex cord tumors. In this category, let's talk about the ovarian fibroma. It's one of the most common stromal tumors. On gross exam, it's a fibroma. It's fibrosing, so it tends to have a very white appearance. The other thing I want you to remember about a fibroma is I want you to remember Meig syndrome. That Meig syndrome is a combination of an ovarian fibroma plus pleural effusions. It's usually right-sided. They can also have ascites as well. The next sort of sex cord tumor is a granulosa cell tumor. These tumors are potentially malignant. And what makes them interesting is that these tumors produce estrogens. So as a consequence, if the person is prepubertal, she will develop precocious puberty. If she's in her reproductive ages, she'll develop irregular menstrual periods. And finally, if she's postmenopausal, all the estrogen will cause her to start bleeding again. It's pretty unique. On gross, since this is a steroid-producing tumor, it tends to have a yellow appearance. Because if you remember your biochemistry, all steroids originate from cholesterol. Cholesterol is yellow in color. This is going to be a yellow-looking tumor. Under the microscope, if you hear about a tumor that has Karl Exner bodies, the diagnosis is granulosa cell tumor. That's pathognomonic. Finally, one of the complications of all this production of estrogen is the endometrium can become hyperplastic and can actually become malignant. You can develop an endometrial cancer due to a granulosa cell tumor. Okay, one other tumor, a sex cord-producing tumor, is a Sertoli Leydig cell tumor. This is an androgen-producing tumor. The thing I want you to remember about this is the patient will start becoming virilized. They'll start growing hair. Their voice may become deeper. If this woman gets pregnant with a female fetus, she could develop female pseudohermaphrodism. The final tumor for the ovary is a metastasis. And for the purposes of the board, the most common tumor that they like to test you on is a gastric metastasis, especially a signet ring cell tumor of the gastric, of the stomach. We call that a Krukenberg tumor when it metastasizes from the stomach to the ovary. That's a Krukenberg. What else goes to the ovary? Well, breast can go there, colon can go there, and endometrial cancer can also go there. Let's continue with the female genital system. We'll talk about gestational trophoblastic disease. First thing I want to talk about is molar pregnancies, also known as hydatidiform moles. Let's start with the incidence. In the United States, it's about 1 per 1,000 pregnancies. It's a tumor of pregnancy. In Asia, much more common than the United States. There is an increased risk at the extremes of the reproductive life, so early in the reproductive life and at the end of the reproductive life. Clinical presentation, it's a tumor of pregnancy, so the patient tends to present with an excessive enlargement of the uterus. The size of the uterus tends to be greater than the dates. She also will come in with vaginal bleeding, and sometimes they'll pass an edematous grape-like soft tissue. That's pretty characteristic of a molar pregnancy. They will also have an elevation in beta-HCG. Under the microscope, you will see edematous chorionic villi, as well as a proliferation of trophoblastic tissues. Fetal tissues can also be present, but they're only present in partial moles, not complete moles. To make the diagnosis, you'll do an ultrasound and you'll look for a snowstorm pattern. And finally, the treatment is going to be endometrial curettage, followed by sequential beta-HCGs. You want to make sure that beta-HCG goes to zero and stays zero. Now let's look at this table. It's table 22.2. It talks about the properties of a partial mole versus a complete mole. Now let's start with a partial mole. It tends to be triploid, and it's caused by one egg being fertilized by two sperm. So they're going to have triploid DNA, 96 chromosomes. It's going to have an elevated beta-HCG. It's going to have hydropic chorionic villi and some trophoblastic proliferation. Fetal tissue can be present. Okay, so if you see fetal tissue on the exam, it's a partial mole rather than a complete mole. And finally, about 10% will invade the myometrium and be called an invasive mole. And choriocarcinoma can occur very rarely. Let's contrast that with a complete mole. It tends to be diploid. In other words, it has 46 chromosomes and they're all from the father. It's basically a sperm fertilizing an empty egg. It tends to have a very high elevation in beta-HCG, lots of hydropic chorionic villi, lots of trophoblastic proliferation, and there's never any fetal tissue. Now, it also has a 10% risk of developing an invasive mole, but the thing that's important is about 2% will develop choriocarcinoma, which is a very highly aggressive malignancy. Okay, we've talked about invasive mole. All that means is one of these moles that has invaded the myometrium. Last thing I want to talk about is a choriocarcinoma. It's one of the most malignant germ cell tumors. It's a tumor of trophoblasts. So under the microscope, you will see a proliferation of cytotrophoblasts, intermediate trophoblasts, and syncytial trophoblasts. Grossly, this tumor tends to be very malignant, so there's a lot of hemorrhage and a lot of necrosis. How does it spread? It tends to spread through the veins, and it goes everywhere. Brain, lung, liver, you name it, it goes there. The good news is, even though it's very malignant, cells are proliferating quickly, it responds very well to chemotherapy. That concludes the female genital pathology system.